The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week I started talking a little bit about wisdom and the views that we have that we see our experience through. The view of the Buddhist teachings, sometimes called wise view or wise understanding, kind of helps to reorient us towards our experience so that we may experience things in a different way because we are orienting our seeing of our experience through some new understandings. Today I'd like to talk about one of the specific teachings, one of the specific wisdom teachings of the Buddha, and that is the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. This is one of the main definitions of wise understanding in the Buddhist teaching. In one sutta it says, what is wise understanding? The knowledge of suffering, the knowledge of the origin of suffering, the knowledge of the cessation of suffering, and the knowledge of the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering. And those four aspects are the aspects of the Four Noble Truths. So this teaching was the first thing that the Buddha taught. When he began teaching, it's the first understanding that he codified in his own mind in terms of what he had experienced and what he thought would be helpful for people to understand. And with this understanding, he not only just stated the truths, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of cessation of suffering, and the truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of suffering, he also indicated that these are not simply truths to be taken in and believed, or just taken in as facts. He offered actions for each of the Four Noble Truths. So these truths, this wisdom teaching of the Buddha bridges the hearing and listening side of wisdom. If you recall last week, I mentioned three aspects of wisdom, that of hearing or listening, that of reflecting and thinking about, and that of cultivating the mind of understanding in our own experience. So these Four Noble Truths come in as that first kind of understanding. We hear them, we read them, we listen to them, and then we reflect on them, think about them. But these four actions enjoin us to practice with them as well. So not simply to take them in, but also to put them into practice. So he says the truth of suffering is meant to be understood. The truth of the cause of suffering is meant to be abandoned or let go of. The truth of the cessation of suffering is meant to be realized, and the truth of the way of practice or the path leading to the cessation of suffering is meant to be cultivated. And I'll talk about each of these, but this really to me highlights the very practical nature of the teachings of the Buddha. It's not about belief, it's about action, it's about practice. So the first truth, the truth of suffering. Suffering is a fact of life. Anyone who says they don't suffer is not really paying attention to what's going on. I think we all recognize it. Now, not to say that we are always suffering, but that suffering is part and parcel of being a human being, of being a living being. The Buddha's definition of suffering. Aging is suffering. Death is suffering. Birth is suffering. Separation from what one loves is suffering. Being with what one doesn't like is suffering. Not getting what we want is suffering. These are all things we experience throughout our lives. We can add some classes of these things in more contemporary terms. Racism is suffering. Poverty is suffering. War is suffering. Global warming causes suffering. Homophobia, sexism, many kinds of prejudice, suffering of feeling different. So suffering is a fact of life. This is what the First Noble Truth states. So the meaning, the term suffering in the Four Noble Truths, the term in Pali is dukkha. I'm sure Gil has mentioned this many times. That term is usually translated as suffering. But the term suffering, I think, we often expand to mean something pretty intense. And the connotation of dukkha is much broader and more subtle than we usually assign to the word suffering. So I like to put out some alternative translations to give you a little bit of the breadth of what it means. Stress, dissatisfaction, unease. So even when our lives are going well, there may be some very subtle ways in which we are just simply dissatisfied with our experience. We want a new wardrobe. We want new shoes. We want to change something. We want a new car. We want to fix our living environment so that it's not so it's the way we want it. It's not the way we don't want it. There's just this constant feeling of dissatisfaction, wanting to fix, change, alter. Very rarely do we land in a place of balance where it's everything's fine. Occasionally we do, but that's the unusual aspect of our experience. Usually we're tumbling forward through this dissatisfaction. The Buddha was amazing. He had an amazing analytical mind, and pretty much he came up with categories and numbers of everything that he talked about. And this is no exception. He said there were three kinds of suffering. There's the suffering due to pain, the suffering due to change, and the suffering due to existence. So the first kind of suffering, the suffering due to pain. So this is the kind of suffering that's the kind of obvious suffering. You know, it's the suffering that we're not going to miss. It's really the suffering around when things are painful in our experience, whether mentally painful or physically painful. The Pali term for this kind of suffering, I like. It really kind of really points to what it says. It's dukkha dukkha. So the suffering, the dukkha of this First Noble Truth is not the physical or mental pain that we are experiencing itself. That might be, I mean, for instance, if we cut our hand, if we cut our hand with a knife, there's some kind of physical pain that goes on simply because we're a human being. So that's not what the Buddha is talking about when he refers to the dukkha or the suffering of the First Noble Truth. What he's talking about is the reactivity to that suffering. The additions that we make in our minds around the suffering, around the pain. So we could look at the cut or the physical pain perhaps as non-optional suffering, and the reactivity as optional suffering. That reactivity is created in our minds. And because it's created in our minds have the capacity to release it. It's not easy, but our minds have that capacity. So the pain that we react to could be mental or physical, and it's usually something that's really unpleasant, or maybe even just slightly unpleasant. And we react to that unpleasantness with aversion, of wanting to get rid of wanting to push away, wanting to fix, change it somehow. Sometimes in physical pain, we react by physically contracting around the experience, which actually can increase the pain physically. I'm sure many of you have experienced something like this. It's like a positive feedback loop when you have a sore shoulder. I mean, I ended up with a frozen shoulder probably because of this kind of thing. You know, the shoulder was a little sore and the arm stopped moving to protect itself, and it just got tighter and tighter and tighter, and finally it got completely frozen and it lasted a year. It's like that is the kind of reactivity that increases a positive feedback loop, increasing that pain. Perhaps even more often we react to some kind of subtle mental or physical pain with a reactive mind, increasing the suffering because that reaction, that aversion itself is unpleasant, compounding the unpleasantness we're experiencing. How many times I have experienced something very small, a small cold, for example, but blew it up out of proportion because I had a presentation to do or somewhere I needed to go, and just like, oh, I can't be this sick. I've got to get over this. That mental suffering just makes the whole situation worse. In certain states of meditation, it's possible to experience strong pain just as strong, unpleasant experience without any reactivity to it. And in that experience, if you experience that in your meditation, you see very clearly that 99% of what we call pain lies in the reaction, not in the physical pain itself. It's quite a startling experience. What we call pain, you know, we usually think of it as the actual physical or mental pain, but most of it is in the reactivity. You can actually experience very strong physical pain, not as pain, but simply dynamically shifting and changing experience. Strong, unpleasant, shifting and changing experience, but not as pain. The second type of dukkha is called the suffering due to change. And this refers to the kind of suffering we experience when something pleasant ends. So even when things are going well in our lives, it only takes a moment for something, it can only take a moment for something to happen. We might be in a car accident. We might have a diagnosis of cancer. A loved one might pass away. These kinds of changes create suffering in our lives. But this suffering of change isn't limited to this very dramatic kind of change. It has many gradations. You know, we might experience we experience suffering when a partner breaks up maybe even just goes away for a business trip. We feel loneliness or sadness. We feel perhaps a little bit of loss or sadness if we break a favorite bowl or mug. These very simple things. We just, a little bit of clinging to something, it's gone, it's lost. We feel some sadness, some suffering around it. Sometimes simply if a period of happiness or joy in our lives, if we've had a particularly up period and that comes to an end, we might feel like we've done something wrong. Why has this happened to me? Why am I not as happy as I was last month? It's simply a fact of life that things change. It works in our favor when things are unpleasant. When things are pleasant, and they change, we feel like something's gone wrong. And again, that's a mental reactivity to that change. We could say, in a sense, that suffering is hidden in pleasant experience. The third type of dukkha is the suffering due to existence. And this, I like to think of this as the Buddhist version of existential anxiety. It's that kind of, is this all there is feeling. You know, we get up in the morning, we shower, we feed ourselves, we go to work, we drive on the freeway, we hang out in the traffic jam, we get to work, we run around all day, we earn the money so that we can go home and buy the groceries, feed ourselves, go to bed, get up the next day and do it all over again until we die. That's the suffering of existence. One way to look at this is to look at how we respond to neutral experience. The suffering of the dukkha-dukkha is how we react to unpleasant experience. The suffering of change, or viparinama-dukkha, is how we react to pleasant experience. And this third one, the suffering of existence, or sankhara-dukkha, can be viewed or looked at through how we react to neutral experience. Do we get bored? Feel indifferent? We can, in a sense, look at our lives, the kind of tapestry of things we have to do to take care of ourselves, as kind of neutral. And yet, we want something to mean something out of it. So looking at that reactivity to the neutral in our lives, we often feel like things are, you know, we get some juice when things are going well, and even we get some juice when things are not going well. You know, that reactivity is kind of how we define our lives, how we feel alive in a way. So checking in and seeing what happens when things are neutral. A very interesting exploration. So the action the Buddha encouraged us towards around dukkha is to understand it. So this means not so much the intellectual understanding, the thinking about, or the reflecting on, well, why am I unhappy because this person did that and they're going to do that tomorrow and I don't want them to do that and they're not doing what I want them to do. That's why I'm unhappy. It's not about that. It's more about the direct experiencing of what the suffering is. In our present moment experiencing, can we understand the suffering as it is experienced in the moment? So we can come to understand in the moment the direct experience of sadness, of loss, of grief. So it sounds a little counterintuitive at times to think about exploring and understanding suffering in this way. I think most of us have the sense of, if I'm suffering, I want to avoid it or ignore it. You know, to not directly pay attention to it. If I directly pay attention to my sadness and loneliness, the thinking is, it will only increase. It will get worse. That may be true in terms of the way we usually pay attention to our sadness and grief, which is in thinking about it. But in the direct experiencing of it, and the letting go of the thoughts and patterns about it, the thoughts and patterns feed that. The thoughts and reflections feed the pattern of the suffering, whereas the direct experiencing of it allows it to live its life without being fed or increased. Everything has a life. Everything has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And with our suffering, what we typically do is whip up the middle. We tend to, you know, keep it going through the way we think about it. We've been trained to think about it this way. So this is kind of a reorientation. This is that reviewing, that wisdom teaching to review our relationship with our suffering in a different way. Can we experience it simply in the present moment? There's a fun poem I like to share about this that talks a little bit about this reframing. This is a Billy Collins poem. called Another Reason Why I Don't Keep a Gun in the House. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. He is barking the same high rhythmic bark that he barks every time they leave the house. They must switch him on when they go out. The neighbor's dog will not stop barking. I close all the windows in the house and put on a Beethoven symphony full blast, but I can still hear him, muffled under the music, barking, barking, barking. And now I can see him sitting in the orchestra, his head raised confidently as if Beethoven had included a part for a barking dog. When the record finally ends, he is still barking, sitting there in the oboe section barking, his eyes fixed on the conductor who was entreating him with his baton, while the other musicians listen in respectful silence to the famous barking dog solo, that endless coda that first established Beethoven as a musical genius. So this practice of viewing our suffering in this way, of experiencing and hanging out with, as opposed to fighting, resisting, thinking about, wanting to fix, wanting to change, this can take time. We need to be compassionate with ourselves about the fact that it doesn't just happen overnight. We need to do this over and over again, reorienting, reframing, observing our experience. And over time, we start to recognize that this kind of attending to our experience reduces our suffering even in the moment. That there's a little bit of a gap, there's a little more space around the suffering that allows us to have some more ease, even though the suffering is still present. The second noble truth, the truth of the cause of suffering. This cause of suffering is said to be craving, wanting. The Pali word is tanha, and it is the Pali word also means thirst. So it's almost got that kind of sense of a kind of a biological urgency to it, this wanting that we suffer over. Now, not all wanting is unskillful. The kind of wanting that's unskillful has the need to have a particular result. It's got this compelling urgency and the need to have things turn out in a certain way. So not all desire or wanting is necessarily bad or necessarily unskillful. We can have a very strong wish to work to end global warming or work to end racism or war or poverty. We can have that very strong wish, and it's very skillful for us. We can have the very strong wish to become free of suffering, and that motivates us on our path. So not all wanting, not all desire is bad, but it's when it's attached to a particular outcome, having to have things turn out in a certain way, in a certain time, we will suffer over that. When we think of wanting, we usually think the word itself, when we think of desire, when we think of wanting, we think of things we want to have bring to us. That's just the way we think about wanting. But this tanha that is referred to, this wanting in the Second Noble Truth, refers not only to things we want to hold to us, but things we want to push away. So both desire and aversion, the movement to get rid of unpleasant and to pull pleasant things towards us, they're both this tanha, this wanting. Essentially, it's a wanting to change experience, whether it's wanting to get rid of unpleasant or wanting to keep pleasant. So it's very natural and normal to respond to pleasant and unpleasant this way. I mean, I think it's built into our biology. It's built into our system. Something's pleasant, we kind of like it, we want it. Something's unpleasant, we don't like it, we don't want it. You can see this in the animal kingdom, in the single cell soup kingdom. We can see this kind of behavior. So it's not it's a natural phenomenon. But we, in our human form, we take this to a pretty strong extreme. As we observe this wanting and not wanting, we start to see that this pattern underlies the majority of our suffering, if not all of it. And the surprising thing is, as we actually begin to observe this in our practice, and again, the Buddha encourages us to observe these experiences, to work with, to practice with these experiences. So if you want to work with this second noble truth, observe wanting in your experience. And as you start to observe this wanting in your experience, you'll start to see that it's the wanting itself that's the cause of suffering, not the thing that we want. We're focused out on the world. We think that what will make us happy is getting that thing, having that thing, or getting rid of that thing, getting it out of our environment. That's what will make us happy. We think that we suffer because we don't have what we want, and we think we suffer because we have what we don't want. And we think that we'll be happy if we can manage to string together a whole bunch of sequences of getting what we want and getting rid of what we don't want throughout our lives. That will make us happy. So just consider a very simple example of like a food craving, of wanting to eat a particular kind of food, like chocolate. If we crave a piece of chocolate and then we get the chocolate and eat it, we get a moment of happiness, of satisfaction, of like, oh, that's just what I wanted, and I got it, so that makes me happy. The craving goes away, and we've gotten what we wanted. This kind of thing happens to us over and over again. The dissatisfaction, that feeling of dissatisfaction goes away when we get what we want. And we think that that is the way to end our dissatisfaction, is to get what we want. The suffering, the dissatisfaction, that unease, when we get what we want, that feeling goes away for a little while, that feeling of dissatisfaction. And we think that's how to get rid of the dissatisfaction. So we get a small relief from that moment of having something. But the genius of the Buddha was to point to not that small moment of happiness that you get when you get something, but the actually greater happiness that you get when the craving goes away. It's not so much the happiness of that moment has more to do with the craving disappearing than the getting what we want. And you can observe this in your own experience. Play with it sometime when you're having some kind of a simple craving. You want something. See if you can just hang out and watch the wanting. Just pay attention to what it feels like and see if you can notice when it goes away. You might, in this exploration, the first few times you do this exploration, you might not actually see the moment it disappears. But sometime later, you know, in the day, you might think, oh, you know, I was watching that wanting for that piece of chocolate and now it's not there. You know, it's not there at this moment. And I don't particularly want the chocolate now, so, you know, I see that it's gone. But you haven't actually seen the wanting disappear. But if you actually can pay attention and actually see the wanting disappear, it feels like you're released from a vice grip. That's where the happiness comes from. The truer source of happiness comes from that release, that letting go of the wanting. And this comes to the action that the Buddha suggested around this, the cause of suffering. Let go of the cause of suffering. Abandon the cause of suffering. Let go of the wanting. Now, this letting go can have a kind of an active quality. Sometimes it can have a kind of an active quality where we actually realize it's not so helpful to hold on to something and consciously say, I don't need that anymore. So it can have that kind of active, I don't need that wanting anymore. I don't need to want that thing anymore. So it can have a kind of an active quality. We can see the uselessness of a particular wanting and let it go. But I think more often it actually has a kind of an allowing quality where we simply allow ourselves to pay attention, to hang out with, for instance, hang out with this wanting for a chocolate craving in this simple example. Just hanging out with it, it goes away by itself. We don't have to try to let it go. Again, impermanence will hold true and it will let go of itself. And that's a lot of our practice, actually, is that being willing to be with that experience of the wanting, of the dissatisfaction, long enough until it releases itself. And it will release itself. The third noble truth is the truth of the cessation of suffering. So for anyone who thinks that the teachings of the Buddha are depressing because they always talk about suffering, this is the true teaching, that it's possible to end it. He really describes very clearly the world that where we suffer, and then clearly describes how it is possible for it to end. So the term used in Pali for the cessation of suffering is Nibbana, or Nirvana in Sanskrit. And the simplest definition, so this is enlightenment. Cessation of suffering is equivalent to what we talk about as enlightenment. The simplest definition that I know of for this is the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, the absence of delusion. The Buddha said that this truth is meant to be realized. The only place we can realize this cessation of suffering is in the present moment. All of these teachings really point us to attending to the present moment, looking at our suffering, looking at the cause of suffering. The only place it's experienced, truly experienced, is in the present moment. We may be suffering about something from our past, but that suffering is being created now, here, because we're thinking about the past and reliving that moment now, here, in the present moment. So suffering occurs in the present moment, and the ending of suffering can occur in the present moment. If we're not mindful, if we're not present, we're not going to experience this ending of suffering. One of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, often says that we actually experience moments of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion a lot in our day. It's just that we don't notice them because they're so subtle. It's a very kind of subtle feeling, this non-clinging. One teacher in the Thai forest tradition, Ajahn Buddhadasa, talks about moments of temporary nibbana, which are these little tiny moments that Joseph Goldstein is talking about. And Ajahn Buddhadasa of these moments says, anyone can see if the states of greed, aversion, and delusion are with us all day and night, every second without ceasing, who could ever stand them? Under such conditions, living beings must either die or become insane and finally die anyway. Let us consider well the fact that one survives because there are periods when the fires of greed, aversion, and delusion are not burning. So Ajahn Buddhadasa states that we couldn't even live, that we couldn't even our lives would be so intolerable if we didn't have these moments of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. So the key is to just begin to recognize them, begin to notice them. Through our practice, we can begin to notice moments like this. Notice, as we observe wanting, that it goes away. As we observe suffering, that the full understanding of suffering gives us space around it. And over time, the full understanding of suffering actually leads to the ending of suffering. Mindfulness functions kind of like putting a car in neutral. If you're driving down 101 at 65 miles an hour and you put the car into neutral, it's not going to stop immediately. But it will stop because we're no longer giving it that forward momentum. And mindfulness has a similar kind of quality like this, that if we simply pay attention to our experience, in that attending to experience, we're no longer giving it the gas. And it will come to an end. We can see that ending of that suffering. That is a moment of what Ajahn Buddhadasa calls temporary nibbana. So we don't actually have to try to realize the end of suffering. It will happen of its own accord if we fully understand the suffering. If we are willing to be present with mindfulness for that momentum and watch it live its life and end. Likewise, we can see the wanting and observe it, hang out with it, and see it end. So through our mindfulness practice, we get little moments, little tastes of release from particular kinds of suffering. And we get a sense that it is possible. It is possible to experience the end of suffering completely. These little tastes give us that hope. The full enlightenment is the complete elimination of greed, aversion, and delusion, even from the tendencies towards greed, aversion, and delusion. So these little tiny moments of nibbana are not the full enlightenment. They are flavors. It gives you a sense of the taste, perhaps, of what that full freedom might be like if you live from a place of non-greed, non-aversion, and non-delusion. The fourth noble truth is the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. So this is the prescription that the Buddha left us with of how to cultivate the path. So this is the action for this path. Develop it, cultivate it. So the Eightfold Path is comprised of eight things. Wise understanding, which is essentially the subject of the four talks that I'm giving this month about wisdom. Starting with wisdom, wise understanding, wise intention or wise thought, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. So the ordering here sometimes makes people think that you start with one and then you just kind of go through them all. You know, one by one. You finish one and then you move on to the next one. But it is called the Eightfold Path because they are really folded on top of each other. You cultivate one and it kind of pulls along many of the others with it. So they're all kind of cultivated simultaneously. And we deepen in our understanding. It's like a spiral through understanding these eight things. And it gets deeper and deeper, the understanding of each of them, as we progress on the path. So the Four Noble Truths are one of the key wisdom teachings of the Buddha. Taking it in, hearing about it, is one aspect of wisdom. Reflecting on it, thinking about it, thinking about how do I suffer? Where do I suffer? How do others suffer? That's reflecting on it, and that's a very, also a very skillful thing to do. How can we end the suffering? But the real fruit of the Buddhist practice comes through the application of this teaching, using this view as a way to see our experience. In one sutta, the Buddha says, someone who attends to experience wisely attends, this is suffering. Attends, this is the cause of suffering. Attends, this is the cessation of suffering. Attends, this is the path leading to the cessation of suffering. Well, this is not just a simply an abstract knowing of the words of the Four Noble Truths. It is applying this as the framework, as a framework through which we see experience. All experience can be seen as one of these four things. Either we're experiencing suffering, we're experiencing the wanting, the cause of suffering, we're experiencing the cessation of suffering, or we're experiencing the cultivation of the path, the cultivation of kindness, of metta, of generosity, of equanimity, of tranquility, of patience, of truthfulness. So the practice of the Four Noble Truths is what leads us to the full understanding of it and ultimately leads us towards the end of our suffering entirely. So I've talked the whole time again. And what I was thinking is next week, I'll talk a shorter time. I think I'll talk about skillful and unskillful, which is another definition of wisdom. But I'll try to keep my talk to about 20 to 25 minutes and then leave a longer period for questions. So over the week, if you want to reflect on some of these topics that we've been talking about in the last couple of weeks, bring your questions because I'll have a longer period of time for questions next week. So thank you all.